Welcome to the meeting of the Research, Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Committee. My name's John Butler. I chair this committee. My colleague Rita Attis is the vice chair of this committee. We thank you for coming. And I will ask now Jessica if you could call the roll.
Trustee Montel Gales.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrera. Trustee Madeline Merchant.
Here.
Trustee Bob Pritchard.
Here.
Trustee Eric Wasowicz.
Present.
Board Chair Dennis Barsima.
Here.
Committee Chair John Butler.
I'm here.
And Committee Vice Chair Rita Attis.
Here.
Mr. Perry, would you please verify that we have a quorum and that the appropriate notice of this meeting has been posted?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. You do have a quorum present. An appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Excellent. Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the agenda for today's meeting?
So moved. Second.
There's a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, the agenda is approved. We did not meet in November of this year, so we have the minutes of the August 2019 meeting before us. I know you all remember that one, and it was very exciting. I was on the phone. Thank you, Trustee Attis, for running that meeting. Let me start with a motion. Can I have a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. So this is an opportunity to make just a few comments. I'd like to say that we're so fortunate today to have Board of Trustees Professor Reed Scheer join us to discuss his research agenda. Professor Scheer is one of our most distinguished professors conducting research in the vitally important area of environmental matters. I've been following Professor Scheer's work for many years. We have so much to be proud of as a university for the work that Dr. Scheer and his colleagues have done and continue to do. We've worked hard as a board to better understand and appreciate the critical function of faculty research in differentiating NIU as an institution. I want to remind my board colleagues that NIU is a national research university, classified as a Carnegie High Research Activity Institution. We learn on page 31 of this meeting packet that the amount of our sponsored and institutional funding spend on research puts us only behind the U of I system and SIU Carbondale, but in the lead among public universities without a medical school. I would add that the Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability will only add to this exceptional profile, and Vice President Blasey will talk more about that today. So this is an opportunity for us to continue our deep dive into understanding the research enterprise at Northern, and thank you for everyone who's here to help us do that. At this time, I would like to recognize the members of the University Advisory Committee representing our Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee. I see the names on my page only match one person who's sitting there. That's Dr. Jason Hanna, who's from the Philosophy Department. But we also have Mr. Royce, Jeffrey Royce, and we have Kendall Thu. Do any of you want to say anything to this committee?
Thank you, Trustee Butler. I just want to join you in welcoming my colleague Reed Scheer to the room. As many of you know, one of the hats that I wear is an advocate for tenure track faculty in trying to communicate the kinds of things that tenure track faculty do and the rigors that we have to go through to, first of all, get our jobs, but then to advance through the ranks of the tenured system. And Reed is a prime example of excellence in faculty, and I very much look forward to his presentation. We have a long history of collaboration, not in his research, but in other parts as well. So thank you. All right, sounds good. Anybody else? Thank you.
Sure. Anyone? Okay. Mr. Perry, has any member of the public registered a written request to address the board in accordance with state law and board bylaws?
Mr. Chair, we do not have any public comments for this committee meeting.
At this point, then, I would ask that Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Dr. Jerry Blasey, provide news for us on our first item, item 7A.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Butler. There is a lot of great news and progress to report. As we heard earlier in the FACFO meeting, at the 78 site south of the Loop, Governor Pritzker announced yesterday the release of $500 million for the Discovery Partners Institute and the Illinois Innovation Network. So those are those letters again, DPI and IIN. The funding includes $15 million for construction of the Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability. And we will see, we understand we will see an immediate release this year of $1.5 million or 10% for design, architectural and engineering services. So we can now fully accelerate the program development process we have had idling, if you will, or at the ready for the last year or so. And that's very exciting. It will really move our scholarly program forward in a number of ways. And the DPI IIN will have an enormous impact on the state in terms of economic development, workforce development, not just in downtown Chicago, but across the entire state. And we're delighted to be involved in that process. As I said, we have a running start, and assuming there are no funding or technical limitations, and we can all hearken back to those occurring, we hope to see the instant installation in place in 2 or 3 years from now. We've also reinforced our staffing for new endeavors like this, and I'm pleased to introduce Mr. Luke Sebi, who has joined the Division of Research and Innovation Partnerships as Director of Innovation Partnerships and Technology Transfer. I believe this is your ninth day on the job.
It is my ninth day.
Yeah. And you found the room.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I walked him over.
So. Okay. He cheated.
He found the Farm Bureau, yes.
Luke comes to NIU from the Virginia Tech Applied Research Corporation, where he served as Vice President of Operations and Development and provided oversight and strategy for development of their research portfolio. He brings great experience, energy, and insight to NIU, and as director, has the charge of promoting strategic university-wide innovation relationships and entrepreneurship for students, staff, and faculty, and the commercialization of their efforts. And you don't have to repeat that back to us, Luke. With respect to our current initiatives and relationships, he'll help manage the development of 71 North Partnership Studio, help and seek develop partnerships for the NIU Opportunity Zone, and NICS, and the Northern Illinois Research Foundation. So with the chair's permission, I'd like to invite Mr. Sebi to say a few words.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to be the Director of Innovation here at NIU. It's a little bit of a homecoming for me. I'm originally from Aurora, Illinois. So it's neat to be back in the state. I've been gone for about 19 years to Virginia and all over the world. I'm a combat veteran, and I have to tell you, I'm more scared to be in front of you to speak than I was in combat. I'm not a great public speaker, but I'm looking forward to serving this community, and I'm looking forward to helping you grow and build and nurture the innovation ecosystem here on campus and beyond. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Very good.
So after a year or so of working at it, we now have a great team in the Office of Innovation. It includes Corinne Bredberg, Mark Hankins, and Chad Glover, so that unit is now up to full staff. But I would like to take this opportunity to recognize Corinne Bredberg, Assistant Director for Commercialization and Innovation, because for an inordinate length of time, she single-handedly carried on all the functions of that office. And I simply can't thank you enough, Corinne. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Luke, I'm a bit of an expert in this area of public speaking, even though I'm not very good myself, but I know a lot about it, and you are actually very good. So you can feel good about that. So we're going to move to other items, but I think, Dr. Blasey, we're going to start with the information item. And so we'll hear from you a little bit about what you might want to add to the discussion that we've already had.
Yeah, so for your convenience, we've repeated the action item from Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and the Personnel Committee titled Change to Full-Time Tenure Requirement. The action item, which passed, will be referred to the full committee, basically allows an important exception to full-time requirement for tenure intended to enable our ability to collaborate with other institutions, museums, laboratories, hospitals, and clinics. We had a bit more of a robust discussion than I expected in the earlier meeting. I would just like to take this opportunity to re-emphasize that these joint positions are for all types of institutions. The action item stressed national labs because that's where the balance of our joint positions are at this time. Given that conversation we had, I'm not sure we need more conversation, but I'm open to questions.
Well, let me ask the trustees if they have any further questions on the matter. Okay, seeing none, then we'll move to item 7B, which is the state legislative report, which is, I believe, going to be delivered orally by Jenna Mitchell.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Our spring session is underway in Springfield. We anticipate it to be a light session with only 13 weeks scheduled. That said, since this fall's veto session, there have been just under 2,100 bills filed, a large portion of those impacting the university. We are uncovering those forms of impact every day. Thanks to the help with faculty and staff here on campus, we're able to get our concerns and our voicing of support to all of the legislators in Springfield that have filed these bills. The governor's budget address is next Wednesday, February 19th. At that time, we'll see what his recommendation is for NIU. Last year, the General Assembly funded higher ed at the governor's introduced budget level. So that's never a set deal, but it is something that we might want to take into consideration when we see what he comes out with next Wednesday. We are again expecting him to recommend an increase for MAP and to see that passed, an additional $50 million to keep us on track with the increase of 100% that he ran on in his last election. NIU's legislative agenda this year is focused mostly around direct funding sources for NIU. That's the $93.6 million for operations that the board passed in August, the release of the $53 million for deferred maintenance capital, and as Dr. Blasey mentioned earlier, two of the other pieces are funding for NICS, the $15 million, which was announced yesterday to be released, and then also the $77 million for the health IT building that was just included in the Rebuild Illinois program this last spring. We have received $7.7 million for that program to move forward. It's kind of just a standard deal that you get 10% up front for planning and building, and then the rest comes on a reimbursed rate. However, this year, NIU's substantive agenda primarily falls under a joint legislative agenda that we developed with the other public universities. There are three different umbrellas under that agenda, the first including funding, which focuses on adequate funding for operations, a MAP increase, AIM High being held steady with zero cohort restrictions, and then a new $35 million grant program for emergency completion grants and for bridge programs that NIU is taking the lead on with partnership with the Partnership for College Completion. This is a new program that would effectively help fund equitable programs on all of the university campuses. The emergency grant program is also eligible for community colleges, but it's something that we are working to move forward. We hope that there might be funding included in the governor's recommended budget next week, but we will not know until we see that. We do have the vice chair of the House Appropriations Committee filing a bill specifically for that $35 million for emergency grants and bridge programs. The second piece of the umbrella is innovation. There are two programs that we are looking to move forward as a public university system. The first is a voucher program, which really looks at attracting existing Illinois businesses to work with public universities. And the second is something that's coined as Illinois Prosper, which looks to attract businesses from outside of the state to move to Illinois to partner with universities on their campuses and work with and employ their students. The third piece of our joint legislative agenda focuses on promoting operational efficiencies. This piece includes procurement reforms to attract minority vendors, which is consistent with what we tried to get moved forward this past session. We've made a couple of tweaks. We've worked with the sponsors. We've worked with other stakeholders to hopefully get those bills across the finish line. Additionally, there's a new legislative initiative to address some repeat audit findings at all of the public university campuses. We've created a joint bill to move forward with some things that might help us in terms of outdated compliance requirements and items such as those. And then also there is a lease agreement extension that we are pursuing so that the university can enter into leases for longer than 10 years. And lastly, but certainly not least, we are pursuing GATA reform to help streamline those reporting processes for grants and definitely mitigate some of the unintended consequences that came along with that bill when it passed a couple of years ago. We know as public universities that we're stronger when we work together, and me and my state relations colleagues at the other public universities have really sharpened this approach this year, and we're really looking forward to a successful session. Lastly, legislative and executive engagements from NIU and its alumni association and its student organizations really reflect how we are growing and expanding at not only a university level, but also a grassroots level. Since our last RILA report, there have been two statewide constitutional officers to come to campus. Most of you probably remember Lieutenant Governor Stratton being at our first kickoff football game. That was a fun event. Also fun, last week we had Treasurer Michael Frericks on campus to co-host an event, a forum on investing in Illinois students, and the Treasurer's Office's preliminary plans on the implementation of the Student Investment Act. The forum's focus was on income share agreements and really exploring the new non-traditional options for eliminating financial barriers for our students. Trustee Pritchard was in attendance. I think it went well. It focuses around some of the interests that we've previously discussed. In coordination with the university's efforts, grassroots efforts among alumni and students have also strengthened in the last year. For our second coming up annual Advocacy Day, we already have 25 RSVPs, and our official recruitment process just started last week. This past fall, we also worked with the Alumni Association to host a series of lunch and learns with a legislator. This is actually a program that was started by Trustee Athis in her former role as chairwoman of the NIU Alumni Association Advocacy Committee, and it's something that has really grown. This past fall, Dr. Streb and I were able to sit on a panel with legislators and engage with nearly 100 alumni who are interested in engaging and advocating for their alma mater, which is exciting to see. There is a student advocate training program that's in place that's been developed with the Alumni Association and the Student Government Association, and that's launching this March. We're hoping to see a stronger attendance from students at this year's Advocacy Day with our faculty, staff, and alumni who are already committed to attend. A couple of upcoming events. This month, on February 26th, we have a joint public university advocacy day in Springfield with a reception to follow at the governor's mansion. He will be speaking at that event on the importance of public higher education, and all of our university presidents will be there. On March 26th, we'll be testifying before the Senate Appropriations Committee on our FY21 request. On April 1st, we have our NIU Second Annual Advocacy Day. And then on April 2nd, just after that day, we've got our House Appropriations testimony on our FY21 request. With that, I am happy to yield for any questions.
Are there questions from the committee on the State Relations Report?
No questions, but I'd make a comment. One, thank you for all of the work that you have done, Jenna, in Springfield and elsewhere in the state on our behalf and for us. Since you joined NIU, we've seen a substantial uptick in terms of work being done in Springfield, so thank you for all that. And also, I would make a comment to the trustees, the April 1st day, I highly encourage you to attend that. I was a part of that last year, and it was a eye-opening for me to see how things work in Springfield, but it was also a lot of fun. And so I would highly encourage you, if you've got April 1st open on your calendar, to attend that day. It was a lot of fun.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to be there on April 1st. Last year I had rotator cuff, so I couldn't twist any arms. Hopefully we'll be able to do that this year.
You could stay for April 2nd, because I'm sure you really miss appropriations hearings. See what it's like from the other side of the table. Yeah.
But I compliment you on bringing in some of the state officers. I know we're still working on the governor, and I think we can get the new chair of the Board of Higher Ed up here soon. So I think it's just great that state people get to see the exciting things happening here on campus.
I will add that we did have a meeting with Chairman Atkinson here on campus just
first week of January.
Yes, yeah. With President Freeman and some leadership. Mm. And that went very well. And I met Ginger Ostro at the event yesterday where the governor announced the $500 million release, and she mentioned that she's interested in coming to campus as well. So hopefully we'll get that scheduled. She has significant history in Illinois education advocacy efforts, so I think she'll be a great partnership.
So, Jenna, I'm just curious. You've been at the job for a little while. You've been through now your second governor since dealing with us. What's your feeling here right now? What are the tea leaves telling you? Are you feeling good momentum? Are you waiting? Is it a wait and see, or how do you feel right now?
Right now, the climate for higher ed seems a little too good to be true, considering where we've come in just the last few years. But I think that there is a real momentum for higher education in the state, and I think the investment made yesterday, the $500 million to really invest state taxpayer dollars into a statewide network of innovation that is being run by the public universities really shows an understanding of how we can drive economic development. And hopefully the education and the advocacy that we've been working on in Springfield is actually working and continues in the way that we see it going.
I just make a comment about Trustee Pritchard's arm from last year. Your rotator cuff problem might have been from the arm twisting you were getting during the legislature. So now go the other way around.
There's a lot of that.
Jenna, can you just comment quickly on the legislative agenda, because that's new, unique, and somewhat mm-hmm. astounding.
That all of the universities have come together. I think that in so many ways, we all have been asking and looking for the same things, but we've never formally put that together on paper and have really come together as one. And I think that what you see here on our joint agenda is that the presidents and chancellors have been in regular communication, all of the state liaisons have been in regular communication, and we're really all working together and pulling in the same direction. And it's really exciting to see. And I think that is, to Trustee Wadsworth's point about the momentum, I think that is a large driver of that momentum, us all working together.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So now we have on our agenda a federal report, and my understanding is that our federal relations director?
Director of Federal Relations.
Director of Federal Relations, close, Anna Quider is on the phone. Is that correct, Anna?
Yes, can you hear me?
Sure can. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Excellent. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today. I apologize for not being there in person, but as you'll hear in my report, this is appropriation season here in Capitol Hill, so it's a busy time in D.C. So today I'm going to update you about current federal relations issues, as outlined in the quarterly report, and also I'll interject a few things that have happened since the report was written. So as I mentioned, I'd like to lead off with appropriations. In December of 2019, fiscal year 2020 appropriations were completed. Now, as a reminder, the federal fiscal year begins on October 1st of each year. Yet, Congress often doesn't complete its appropriations work until December or sometimes into early the next calendar year. Nevertheless, fiscal year 2020 funding is very positive for NIU priorities. In fact, there were no cuts to NIU priorities across education and research, and most programs actually saw increased funding. And for a couple of examples, the maximum individual health grant award increased by 2.4% to $6,645, and the Department of Energy's Office of Science, which includes support for Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory and Arbaugh National Laboratory in Illinois, saw a 6.3% increase. And I have a few more examples that I lay out in my report. And I'm happy to answer questions about any of your favorite programs as well. Looking ahead to fiscal year 2021, President Trump just released his budget request on Monday of this week. And looking at his budget request, overall for NIU priorities, it's a very similar budget request to what we've seen coming from him for the past 3 years. It proposes cuts to many of NIU's priorities. However, so the good news, though, is that the budget process is a negotiation between Congress and the White House, and Congress and the White House have already negotiated the overall spending level for fiscal year 2021, and that funding level, though, only has $2.5 billion, or less than 1% more, for fiscal year 2021 compared to last year. So that really limits the flexibility that Congress and the White House will have on being able to provide increases to NIU priorities. But of course, we will still do our best to hold the line and fight for increased funding as we can. And as you're all aware, we are in a presidential election year, so that makes it difficult to move legislation and including spending bills. In fact, when we had, if you look back to the previous administration, when we changed from the Obama to the Trump administration, we didn't see a budget from President Trump until August of his first year. And so if we do end up having an electoral result in November, which will change administration, we could be in a situation where we're on an extended continuing resolution. And I even was on the Hill yesterday and heard some staff talking around even a full year continuing resolution. And what a continuing resolution does is it just puts in law that you will continue the current spending into the next fiscal year. And so continuing resolutions, they have a time period associated with them. They can be as short as a day and as long as a year. So there's a bit of uncertainty in how fiscal year 2021 is going to shape up. But looking at the administration, turning to the administration, NIU has recently engaged with the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy on a number of issues. It's bill that in the House majority is called the College Affordability Act. It passed out of the House Education and Labor Committee on a party line vote, including with the support of Congresswoman Underwood, who is NIU's only, or Illinois' only representative on that committee. And it passed in October 2019 from the committee. It is unclear whether this legislation will gain traction in the House and in the Senate, but that is an effort underway. Finally, turning to our federal engagement with NIU, I am pleased to let you know that Professor Chao Yu of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry was invited by Congressman Kissinger to represent the 16th Congressional District at the Energy and Environment Innovation Showcase on Capitol Hill in December. And he was joined by representatives from industry and academia from across the country talking about what they're doing to move the country forward with energy and environment space. And then looking forward, planning is happening in earnest for NIU's annual congressional reception. It's taking place this year on March 11th on Capitol Hill. This event, as in the previous couple of years, is being done in partnership between federal relations, the Alumni Association, and the foundation. And I am pleased to let you know that we currently have four confirmed congressional speakers. Those are Congresswoman Robin Kelly and Congressman Don Bacon, who are NIU alumni, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who represents our DeKalb campus, and Congresswoman Lauren Underwood, whose district is home to 28,000 NIU alumni, which is the largest of any congressional district. We're also planning for a number of congressional meetings for President Freeman and our future faculty surrounding the reception. So thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Dr. Quider? Okay. Dr. Quider, thank you so much for your report. You're welcome to continue to listen to our meeting, but we'll move on if there are no questions. The next item that we have on our agenda does not come with an oral presentation, and that's the Sponsored Program Administration Quarterly Report. Assistant Vice President Dara Little works on this quite a bit. She's here, as well as, of course, Dr. Blasey, to answer any questions the committee has about this. Any questions? I did reference page 31, which I think provides some very interesting data that is explained on 31 and then charted on 32. I hope everyone will get a chance to look at that carefully at some point if they haven't.
So, Chair Ben Butler, I'd just like to make a comment.
Sure.
Assistant Vice President Little asked me to update the number. Now we're currently at $21 million in external funding. And I would also like to repeat your observation that in 2018 we ranked fourth amongst the Illinois publics without a medical school. There's a lot of qualifiers there, but it's quite significant. And we have seen a continual increase in our research expenditures over the past few years. We are gearing up for an expected increase because of NICS and the new PhD programs that have been approved. So, you know, we're planning for growth.
Great. Excellent. These are really good numbers, and thank you for your work on the report, as always.
I'm sorry. Can I just add, did you say, Jerry, that the FY20 number is now $21 million?
That's correct. Goes up every week.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to just point out that the numbers that are being shared in this chart are a combination of sponsored projects, money coming from external sources, as well as university investment in research. That's correct.
Not this chart. This chart is external funding.
Right.
There's a metric that we use in the industry, if you will, to measure the intensity of scholarship and research, and that's something called science and engineering expenditures. It's a self-reported number that we submit to NS every year, as do all the other research institutions. And that metric is widely used as sort of an understanding where you stand relative to other institutions. And specifically, we're at 255, and it's 247, and it's been a steady increase every year for the past 5 years or so. Three, okay.
Now, you made the comment, Jerry, that you anticipate that with NICS and other things coming online that we'll have more opportunities for funding. So from a NIC standpoint, will those be grants that we will still have to apply for and go after, or will funding come to us simply because of the research and the work that we're doing?
I think both. Sustainability? I think both. We'll certainly have more facilities and equipment and programs that will be interesting to the funding agencies and a broader set of funding agencies. And also, just having this new facility should attract additional investment from the private sector as well as the government. So the answer is both.
You anticipate that a lot of that will be federal?
Certainly a significant. Right now, our funding is about half federal. So half to three quarters, and it should be so much of that. But I would really like to see an uptick in the private sector, and we're working on that.
The opportunity zone and the agencies.
Yeah, so President Freeman reminds me that NICS is in the opportunity zone, and we're working very hard on planning activities, both the university and the foundation, to build out opportunities to exploit the opportunity zone. Yeah, you use opportunity so much.
Great, thank you. Go ahead.
Dr. Blasey, I'm just curious that I'm looking where all the money is coming from here and everything. I see Ohio University for $172,000. What?
Dara, do you know the details?
I don't know the details, but most likely that's what we call flow-through funding.
Okay.
It's likely that Ohio University has a federal grant, and they're giving a portion of that grant to NIU.
Got it, okay.
Very often, faculty will collaborate with their colleagues at one university, and one or the other university will take the lead on a federal submission.
Okay.
Then the money flows through
that
them.
Makes sense. Yep. Just another MAC school. I mean, the other ones, I can kind of see Harvard would definitely want to be dealing with us.
Soon.
Well, they're on there.
Oh, and, they are. Okay.
But
more.
Interesting.
Okay, so I'll turn now again to Dr. Blasey, who will introduce our final speaker, Dr. Reed Shear.
Yeah, as a regular item of agenda item, we feature a report on scholarship from the faculty, and we try to mix it up, sometimes research, sometimes artistry, sometimes scholarship history, for example. And today, in a nod to efficiency, we actually have a dual function presentation, which offers the sabbatical report that Provost Ingram mentioned earlier this morning, and a description of the process behind publication. And we thought it would be very interesting for the board to understand the lifelong, decade-long commitment required to have a publication in a discipline. So to do that, Dr. Reed Shear will discuss his recent sabbatical and give you a sense of how important sabbaticals are to scholarship and to instruction. So Reed.
Okay, well, thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it. I confess I was rather confused when I was first asked to do this, because I was asked by the two different committees quite separately. And so, what is my task? And, well, it's both, because both of the main themes are part of what I wanted to talk about today. So I wanted to talk about sabbaticals and also a bit about the scientific method and how what the role of faculty is and what the process of faculty and student engagement in research activities. So it's representing both of your committees. Okay, so many of you will remember the WIZARD project, which I won't give you the acronym, but it was a process of drilling into the interior of West Antarctica to learn the history of the ice sheet. I have to apologize that our container says Northern Illinois University on mustard yellow. I would have liked to have had it painted red, but that was extra costs that we couldn't bear. So we had to stick with the yellow. But as you know, it was quite a large project that NIU was one of the leads on. And the point of it was to drill through the ice sheet and study the biological systems underneath the ice, and also study the history and stability of the ice sheet. And this, of course, is very important to society, because we are seeing changes in the Antarctic ice sheet that are not only unprecedented in our observations, They are much more rapid than we ever would have predicted when I was a graduate student first looking into some of these questions. And it seemed like the changes that were predicted were a worst case scenario for 100, 200 years from now. And we're seeing some of the warning signs that were hypothetical back in the 70s and 80s. And many of you will remember that we made a big splash when we found, whoops, what did I do? When we found fish and other little creatures underneath the ice. And Ross Powell and I were on Chicago Tonight, and everybody wanted to hear about the fish. But we had lots of other really important research discoveries, and most of the discoveries take a lot more gestation time before you can get them to publication. It's not just a matter of, hey, we found fish. There are fish in the ocean. Amazing. Although it was an interesting discovery. Our research was based on drilling through the ice and taking samples of the sediments, the mud underneath the ice. And so here's Ross Powell from my department and myself, and my student Jason Coonan, who I'll introduce in a little while, was there as well. Although he was supposed to be in the field season in 2014, that was canceled because of the government shutdown. So that was supposed to be the start of his master's program, and he had to bide his time for a year, unfortunately. But after we made this one really, and I won't get into the scientific details of what our discovery was, but we made a very surprising discovery when we started our analyses of these sediments, something that was counter to what the prevailing view of what the ice sheet had been doing since the last ice age. And so we broadened our analyses out to look at samples that we'd recovered years ago, including samples that were recovered from the geology department at NIU in the 1970s by Peter Webb, who was my PhD advisor at Ohio State, but he used to be the chair of the department here back in the 70s. And so still working with these materials that were recovered decades ago. And so in essence, what our chief finding is, and I don't know if someone can, there's a little clicked. If not, we won't worry about it. I'm not sure how to run it from here. But that's a video of a computer model that we had developed based on some of our findings. But our chief finding was that the ice sheet, which retreated after the last ice age, which had its peak around 18,000 years ago, and it started coming back, and there was a prevailing view as to what it did, basically that the current configuration of the Antarctic ice sheet is the minimum configuration that had been seen since that time period. And what we discovered, which was quite surprising and quite controversial, was that the ice had been much more dynamic than that, and it pulled back much further, and then it re-advanced. So it retreated beyond the current configuration and then started re-advancing. Now, this is kind of heartening because it shows that there is some resilience in the system, but it's also worrisome because it shows that it's a very, very dynamic system, even more so than we thought. So we made this discovery. We want to publish it. So to publish it in the scientific literature is not just a matter of writing up what you discovered and sending it off to a journal and having it published. We have to convince extraordinarily knowledgeable, smart, stubborn, skeptical colleagues to change the way they're thinking about things, change the way they've been thinking about something perhaps for decades in light of this new discovery. So as you can imagine, it's not that easy to convince a PhD to think about something differently than the way they've been thinking about it for a long time. Consequently, when we want to publish a paper, we want it to be noticed. We want to get the maximum impact out of it. So when we have something that is really new and is changing the conversation, then of course we shoot for the stars and try to go for the most competitive of journals where we'll get the most impact. But we also know, and so I cited nature as the top of the heap, where few scientists even submit papers to Nature, and when you submit them, most of them just get sent back by the editor. A select few of them may go out for review, and a very select few of them ever get published. So it's quite a vetting process that takes place. Now, I knew, just writing up the results that we found in our group and sending it off, was going to be met with pushback. They were going to say, we contaminated our samples. They were going to say, we got it wrong because this is not the way we've been thinking about it. You need, when you have an extraordinary claim, you need extraordinary evidence. We were quite confident in the quality of our evidence. But nevertheless, we were going to be convincing skeptical people. So writing that paper up is going to be a real challenge. And so a sabbatical was really necessary because, as many of you know, we are a national research university, but the really, really big research universities, typically the faculty have a lower teach load than we have here. So we're doing our research and we're doing our teaching, but we have a higher bar than some of our colleagues at some of the bigger schools sometimes have to surpass. So, okay, so for the sabbatical that I was awarded, a one semester sabbatical in the fall of 2016, and so in order to get a place where I could not just have some quiet time without teaching to write up the results, but also an environment where I could have an intellectual interaction with colleagues. So I wrote to the sort of the premier geological research institution in the world, at Columbia University, the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, and I was offered a formal invitation, to have an office and a desk, and I could come there and do my research. So, as is typical, when I went there, and in the first week or two, I gave a talk. Now, this was the first test. I was going to be presenting to all these big name people in the field a story that wasn't the story that they had been taught. And so I was sort of bracing myself for people to start throwing things at me. At this talk, there's a young guy sitting near the back who is practically jumping out of his seat. He couldn't wait for my talk to be over, and he jumped to his feet with his hand in the air. Not with a question, but to say, I found the same thing. And he was grappling with the same situation, that he had completely different data set from a completely different part of Antarctica, but it was telling the story I was trying to tell. Same kind of response of the ice sheet. And he was grappling with, how am I going to write this up? I know people are going to shoot it down, especially since I'm a new guy. So he was a assistant professor who had been recently hired, so out to make his name, hoping to get tenure, trying to get the big paper published, and he knew that he was going to have a challenge to do it. So this was an opportunity for us to join forces in a way that never would have happened if I hadn't have been at the Earth Observatory. So we decided to bring it together and join forces, and instead of us trying to publish our papers on our own, we'd have much bigger impact if we told the story more holistically. And so joining also with an ice sheet modeling colleague in Germany at the Potsdam Institute, we put this story together. Now, the first three authors are co-lead authors, and since he was the untenured professor, I said, you go first. You need it more than me. But in any case, we did get this paper published in Nature. We had several co-authors here from NIU, including Ross Powell and Nathan Stansel in the department, and also Jason, who's here as a co-author as well, and one of our alums as well was one of the co-authors, Slavik Tolacek. He's on the faculty at University of California, Santa Cruz now. And here's what the result was, without getting into the scientific impact. It's getting a lot of citations. And in fact, there's a metric that's used to see the impact of the research papers. And this paper is ranking still to this day in the top 1% of research papers published internationally. I reiterate, if I had just written this paper based on our data, which was good, solid data, and sent it to Nature, there's a very good chance they would have sent it back to me. But having that interaction with another group, making it sort of interdisciplinary, is what really gave it strength. And I also want to point out that this, of course, is not the only prominent paper to come from the Wizard Project. We had another Nature paper and a bunch of other papers, and a number of them were led by students. And I'm highlighting one that was just published online in mid-December and was just formally published and in print form this week. And Jason is the lead author on that, and we have colleagues from a number of universities, Louisiana State and University of Massachusetts are co-authors on this paper, and this is a top disciplinary journal. Now, we did, of course, send it to one of the Nature journals first, and it made the first pass, and it went out for review, and it got strong reviews, but wanting a lot of changes, and it wasn't really clear what it would take to satisfy them. So we went another iteration, submitting it here and eventually getting it published there. And so, which brings me sort of the next point I want to make, a little bit about the process. It is we put our, not just our time and intellectual effort into these. These projects become very personal to us. And so it takes a level of dedication beyond just coming and doing the work. And especially when you're new in the field, you put all your effort into something and then you put it out there and it's basically putting it on the firing squad and seeing how many holes get shot through it in the process. So what it really requires is patience, perseverance, and a very, very thick skin. And this is also true with regard to generating research funds. And Jason, do you mind if I put you on the spot if you have anything you might want to add to that?
But Jason, you have to go to the microphone.
Yeah. Saying you build up a thick skin. So in 2014, when we initially started working with these samples that led to the Nature paper and this paper, we were kind of scrambling because I had a master's to do and I didn't really have much to work on. And so we went to these old samples that were donated to us by Slavik Tulacek. And so
some that I recovered as part of my PhD.
This is true. Yeah. And so that experience, right, and sort of persevering through that and getting that field season that ultimately led to these papers was a mini learning lesson. And then in 2016, when Reed was on sabbatical, we were talking about the first drafts of this paper. And it was submitted, like Reed was saying, about four times, four different journals, until we landed on Geophysical Research Letters. And so there was about four or five rejection periods, right?
No, they weren't. He's calling it rejections, but they were always encouraging a resubmission. So that's not a rejection. That's just you need to still work on.
Yes. Boyfriend. Yes. And so, yes, it's a tough process, but ultimately worth it.
Oh, we were rejected.
So his character has been built. So what? Why do we do this? Why do we put so much effort forth? Well, you know, obviously we want to build our careers, but these again are personal projects. So it's really reflecting our own sort of interest. We can't explain why we got interested in this project necessarily. It's just, but once you're there, it's your baby. And so when you send it off and you're proud of it and it comes back shot full of holes, it hurts, but it's a really, really important process toward developing top-notch research that will have impact to the scientific community and to society. So I didn't just write the paper during the sabbatical. Here are some of the other things. You can read them yourself. I gave talks. I while at Columbia University, because they've got lots of foundation money, I applied for some additional money, and that money was used to support undergraduate students, including one of those students was one of our DACA students, who since graduated and is happily making money now, although I've been trying to convince him to come back to grad school. And new research collaborations, and also quite a bit of media attention. While I was there, I had a different paper come out that drew a fair bit of media interest. So I had interviews in the Washington Post and with Popular Science and a whole bunch of others, and it's calculated that the media contacts that I had during the sabbatical amounted to a potential of about 60 million readers. But when that science, or when that Nature paper came out, that was picked up by, I was very busy on the phone, because it was picked up by about 40 different news outlets around the world, and leading to a reach of about, 215 potential readers, not counting Facebook and Twitter. And this has been calculated at a value to NIU in terms of advertising of about $2 million, this media attention. So here's the timeline, as I see it for my field, and it's a little different in different fields. When you're in Jerry Blasey's field and you have to, building a piece of equipment that it takes, 20 or 30 years to develop, it's very different. If you're sending a sensor on a satellite, then you have to wait for the launch, and the launch gets scrubbed, so that can be much more extended. And doing field work in Antarctica is not that different. You end up with delays that you can't help. But basically, when you start with an idea and you cultivate that and build it into a hypothesis that is mature enough that you can create a reasonable competitive proposal, then that takes a couple of years just at the outset. Then you submit it, and then you have to wait. You have to wait a year. In fact, in an hour or at 2:30, I've got a call with my program manager about a pending proposal now, so I'm going to do a little lobbying there too. I mean, giving him information that would be useful to him. So this kind of lays out the fact that it really does take 5 to 8 years to see a project to ultimate conclusion, and sometimes you have to go several times around. And let's point it out that this is not that different from a startup business. You have an idea for a business you want to get going. What do you have to do? First, you got to do a lot of research to see if it's a viable idea before you even talk to anybody about it. Then once you have that built to the level where you can, you can see that there's a real kernel of possibility there, then you got to start begging for money. Money for the development before money for getting it going. And it takes a lot of time before you'll have a profitable a business. And so it's sort of comparable. Okay, so last slide. The reason why we have sabbaticals, and the reason why sabbaticals are important, especially at research universities, is that, first of all, when you have our faculty going to another institution, they are learning about us. Okay? Which means that's going to be a place, NIU will be a place where some of my colleagues are looking for graduate students. They know they came from our program and that it's a strong program. So it really is an important part of professional development for the faculty, ultimately increasing the likelihood of funding, and it also informs and revitalizes pedagogy, because usually we're at other universities, we're comparing notes, taking a break from teaching, you come back to it fresh, and over that sabbatical, often we'll spend time revitalizing a course that we've been teaching for years, and maybe it's gotten a little bit rusty. So you don't have that opportunity when you're in the teaching cycle to really do that. But when you get a sabbatical, you have that opportunity to do it. So it basically offers you all kinds of different connections that are really important, and really important for our students as well, students and former students. So all of it comes back supporting NIU's mission of teaching as well as research in artistry, and that's those are my messages for you today. And Jason and I would be very happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Scheer.
Yeah, it's great seeing you again, Dr. Scheer. Can you go back a couple of slides to the paleo gene? So I know that era was 66 million years ago and lasted for 40 some million years.
Well done.
Why did you pick? I mean, why that era?
That is a critical part of the development of climate on the planet. Was when did Antarctic ice sheets start forming? And you know, it really was a major step toward the world that we as a species developed in. And there had been published models which were just based on theory as to what Antarctica looked like. And the way what Antarctica looked like at that time is critical for when you start building up ice. And the sediments underneath had these microscopic fossils that Jason studied and our colleagues that indicated both terrestrial land environments from that time and marine environments. And it really was the first test of a model that had been universally accepted but not quite right. And so the real revolution here was providing direct evidence of what had been theoretical before.
A logistics question. You have a sabbatical. How often can you take a sabbatical? Because 8 years, I take it you're working on multiple projects at one time.
Always. Okay. And so you don't get them all that often. And you know, we'll understand. We have other, you know, our contract is 40-40-20, and what that, you know, 40% research, 40% teaching, 20% service, and what the actual breakdown for each individual faculty in terms of our workload varies tremendously, not just within the university, but between universities. But sabbaticals are an earned opportunity. We don't see them as an entitlement, or at least I don't see them as an entitlement. I see them as something that an opportunity that's earned.
So when you went through the hypothesis stage, mm-hmm. did you anticipate what you ended up with?
No, not at all. I mean, there are other parts of our research we did I did anticipate, and some of this was going back to the hypothesis that I put forth as a PhD student when we made our first hole through the ice sheet, and I said there's one way to test what the ice sheet has done before, and it's by looking at these microscopic fossils. And so that, I mean, you know, from my graduate work ended up as a science paper, a paper in science. And this was following up, and so a lot of it was confirming things that we knew. But the fact that the ice had gotten smaller than it is now, that was totally unexpected. When we first did the analyses, this was based on radiocarbon analysis. When we first did these analyses, we thought, is this right? Can this be right? And then we started checking all the other samples and getting a similar result. So we knew it was quite robust.
You help us just so everybody hears it. So you track earlier glacial retreat.
Yeah, right? Well, we're looking for the entire history,
yeah.
But we only get snippets.
Right.
Because, as you know, we're all built on glacial deposits here, right, from when the ice sheet was all the way here. And so what does a glacier do when it's advancing? It's eroding and it's mixing things up. That's why our soil is so good, because it's mixing up so much different stuff. Same thing happens in Antarctica, and we're looking for fossils that we can identify as specific ages mixed into these glacial sediments underneath the ice. So it's a complex thing to sort of tease out the different time periods. So some of our evidence is for the last glacial cycle over the last, you know, 100,000 years or so. Some of it is going back 50 to 55 million years.
And that tells us that the current state of glacial retreat is really rapid and problematic.
Yeah, some of the observations we made with Wizard, including the melt rates that are going on right now, are extraordinary. And Jason, after doing this initial work, he went out on the ocean drilling vessel, the Geordie's Resolution, off of South Africa, just when he was finishing his master's. And has been working on that as well. And then this time last year, I was out on that ship off of Antarctica on the drill ship. And right now, we've got a number of projects that are really looking at the details of how the ice sheet has changed over time, and colleagues looking at the ice right now and how it's changing over time. We're learning a tremendous amount. And it's, we're not exaggerating. We're not making it up. It's really kind of shocking what's going on right now.
So how many other people like you, professors, are out in the Antarctic doing this type of research then?
You mean internationally?
Yeah, I mean.
Are you bumping into people?
Yeah. A lot of the work that I've done is going via the McMurdo Station, which is the largest base in Antarctica, the U.S. base. And in peak season, there are maybe about 800 people at the base. A percentage of that are scientists. Most of them are support people, construction, the tradespeople that keep the place running. During peak season, which is the wintertime here, summertime there, there may be, what do you say, Jason? A couple hundred scientists, maybe? Internationally at different parts of the, and this is, this is a continent that's this, the size of the U.S. So it's a big area with a smattering of research going on. And it's gotten tougher to get the funding, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. The photo on the first couple of slides, is that a photo of you and a colleague working out there?
Yes, that's Ross Powell in the department as well. He's been on our faculty since 1980.
And then my second question is this research particularly dangerous? Drilling into the Antarctic ice sheet kind of sounds like it could be the next horror movie setting.
Well, there's a risk in everything we do, isn't there? It's a lot safer than it used to be, but still, We're flying in old aircraft. One of the planes we flew down on was literally a 1941 DC-3 with skis. Obviously, new engines and electronics. It's been reconfigured, but the fuselage was built in 1941, and we have the ski equipped Hercules, which are mostly from the 70s that are still flying, and we are in desperate need of a new icebreaker. To maintain all of this, the consistently Congress is this is one of those things that comes up every year, and they say next year, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to do some of this research just with U.S. resources.
Okay. Absolutely.
So, first I want to thank you for taking the time to make this presentation on behalf of your faculty colleagues. And I just want to call out two things that are very obvious to me but may not be obvious to everyone else and I think are very important. And they're important about Reed Shearer, but they're also important about faculty who do less sexy research, who stare into microscopes or work in a hood and rarely leave Montgomery Hall or, another one of our buildings. And that is, a lot of times we hear people who don't have the privilege of sitting in a presentation like this say, if they're good researchers, they can't be good teachers. And that's just ridiculous. I think you can see from the ability of Dr. Shearer to put together a story to captivate this audience, to make very complicated things obvious to us, that being a good researcher, especially one who's competitive for grants and who publishes widely, means that you are a good teacher, that you can reduce complex concepts to things that everyone can understand and do it with incredible enthusiasm. And I think that that's something that's very, very important to call out. And then, I just feel like we are so fortunate at NIU to have faculty who not only are good teachers, but who care so deeply about our undergraduate mission at the same time that they're really working to advance the frontiers of science. And I think that that's also very, very important. And also to have faculty here who are so dedicated not only to training the next generation of scientists through their interactions with graduate students and undergraduate students, but to think about succession planning, helping faculty at other institutions, and moving forward in that way. And so thank you very much for everything that you do and for the great example that you've shown us today.
Thank you for the kind words. And I did forget that we've brought not just grad students to Antarctica, we've brought undergraduates as well through the years. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Committee members, are there other matters to come before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is May 14th, 2020. May I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
There's a motion. There's a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? The meeting is adjourned.